Yeah, we try to structure these three presentations in a way that we thought there would be a logical flow. So I'm trying to refer to Chris' paper in my own presentation. But I have to, I have to introduce it saying that this is an attempt to bring together several and quite different strands that right now are floating in my work. What I want to do is to try and link the notion of culture with notions of citizenship, as I believe this could be maybe an answer to Chris' question, i.e. what can we do about multiculturalism and what sort of language can we use to talk about multicultural ideals. And I think that it would work quite well in Australia right now. I'm not the first person to talk about cultural citizenship. There are several books written by political scientists and sociologists. My approach is a bit different. I am an art theorist by, my background is art theory, and my approach has quite a lot to do with cultural and postcolonial studies on one hand, and on the other, it has to do with Italian post-autonomous Marxism. So my thinking on this matter is also in depth to a number of conversations that we have been having at Transforming Cultures in the course of the past year. A conversation that I've had with my colleague Paul Allerton, who directed me towards a very important body of work on cultural citizenship that was developed by the Cultural Studies Latino group towards the mid-90s, in particular by Renato Rosaldo, and conversation that I have with my Italian colleagues, in particular Sandro Mezzada. Conversely, there is because of the nature of my research projects that are pretty much involved in activist practices in Italy on one side, and I am starting a new research project with Information and Cultural Exchange that is a community and new media arts organization in Western Sydney. My ideas also have quite a lot to do with what these people do in the everyday, the putting into practice, if you want, of cultural citizenship. So my question, I guess, is why should we introduce culture in our thinking about citizenship? And let me start by saying that I don't mean that we need to add cultural rights to a list of already existing human rights, legal rights, or civil rights. But what I would like to do is to bring about maybe a qualitative shift in the way we think about citizenship and reimagine citizenship starting from culture. And the reasons are multiple, and the reasons why, culture as, if you want, communication, culture as creative industries, culture as information flow is important today are really too many to list here. Let me say that, for instance, according to some economists, culture as communication is now at the core of production in the present phase of capitalism. Somebody called this cognitive capitalism, or somebody called it post-Fordism, somebody called it high technology capitalism. In this strand of theory, what happens to labor is that it becomes immaterial labor, and there are several critiques that one can move towards the idea that labor is becoming immaterial. Generally, people point out to Chinese factories, and the general answer to that is that even workers in Chinese factories have to build into their work practice some form of communication and immateriality. Not to mention the fact that the leading sectors in places like the United States are completely immaterial, such as, for instance, the you know, the cultural industry, the film industry, and so on. And to go back to China, new form of labor that I find particularly interesting is gold farming, which is people who play online games for people in the United States who do not have time to play their own online games and put together gold in terms of online games. So that is a form of immaterial labor, even if it is structured as a factory. Other reasons why culture is important, I think, in this discussion about citizenship is that culture has, and this ties in with what Chris was saying, culture has replaced other categories, such as race intended as a biological category to signify difference. So Etienne Balibar calls this new type of racism a differentialist racism, a racism that does not rest upon the concept of race but on the concept of culture and cultural practices. And I think that we see this very well in Australia. And what I want to do now is to specifically look at this idea of citizenship as it has been introduced in the public discourse quite recently. With the change in the name of the Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs to Immigration and Citizenship. That was announced on the 23rd of January this year. And John Howard did this announcement. He didn't take any questions on this specific matter at the press conference that he held that day, but he replied to one question the day after. So on the 24th of January, at question time, one journalist asked, "What do you say to those people who are fearing that this, the change of the name from multiculturalism to citizenship, is some kind of condemnation of other cultures or downgrading the role of multiculturalism in Australia?" And John Howard, and I will have to read the whole quote here, John Howard quite, as usual, responded, starting with, "Well, they are wrong." And he continued, "This is not condemning cultures. It's just positively asserting the obvious and effect, and that is, immigration should lead to citizenship. And the path is you come to this country, you embrace its customs, its values, its language, you become a citizen. You don't lose a place in your heart for the country you came from, and you are not expected to. I've always said that, and people are understandably going to retain a place in their heart for their home culture, and we don't discourage that. But the premium dominant consideration must be the integration of people into the Australian family. That's always been my belief. It was my belief before I became Prime Minister, and it continues to be my belief. But that can sit comfortably with total respect for different cultures and total respect for the fact that somebody born in China or Croatia will retain a place in his or her heart for the customs, the manner, and the tempo and so forth of his or her birthplace." So talking about paternalism. So this answer I find, I heard some of this on the news, and then I went back and read the transcripts on John Howard's website. And I find it very simple, but at the same time very, very complex, because there are a number of ideological underpinnings that inform John Howard in an apparently very benign and paternalistic type of answer. The first consideration to do is that immigration should lead to citizenship. Therefore, citizenship is not organic. It's not, a birthright, but it's a process of becoming. The second one, and which I find for this discussion on cultural citizenship is probably most relevant, is that Howard defines citizenship purely in cultural terms. There is no trace of legal, political, or social values. Citizenship, the path to citizenship is customs, values, and language. So it is a cultural grammar that can be acquired and that must be performed to become Australian. I would like to stress that the performativity is here implicit. It is by doing something that one is or isn't Australian. This in turn leads to a hierarchical construction of citizenship based on distinction, because one can perform customs or values or language in different degrees of closeness to this ideal of the Australian family that John Howard has, you know, firmly in his head. So, for instance, a migrant will never perform Australian citizenship as well as somebody who is born in Australia. So no matter how many lamingtons I bake, I will never be a perfect Australian. Okay. And May Joseph, examining the link between migrancy and citizenship, and linking it to her own experience of a Sri Lankan in Tanzania, talks about inauthentic and nomadic citizenship. And I find this notion of the inauthentic citizen quite interesting. This relates also to another point that is implicit in John Howard's speech, which is that citizenship is a public cultural practice and it is opposed to private cultural practices of migrancy. And Howard here went quite poetical and called those the customs, manners, and tempo of the birthplace. So there is a tension between public and private that also mirrors another tension, that is between the nation space, Australia as a nation space, and the transnational and multiple networks of belonging that migrants bring into Australia. And somehow this network of belongings contributes to disrupt the notion of the Australian nation space as a smooth space. So in, another thing that is implicit in John Howard's view is that ethnicized cultural difference can only thrive in domestic situations. The public agora, the public square that in the Enlightenment was the space where all citizens were theoretically equal and theoretically could meet, in our terms, become a public space where everybody is the same. So it is not about equality, it's about sameness, homogenization. And this slippage from equality to sameness is very interesting, because I think it's also it also points to the weakness, which I think is that at the core of this notion of citizenship as an abstract and as a universal category. Because it is this universal is continuously disrupted by appearances and very precise singular embodiments. With embodiments, I mean very literally categories that are visibly inscribed on bodies, such as race and gender and class, and categories that in a way have an impact on full democratic participation. So translated in contemporary Australian terms, this means, for instance, a different distribution of entitlements and endowments to different categories of migrant. Think about somebody in Nauru as probably the bottom end of disenfranchised person, and think about a skilled migrant from United States as, you know, a different type of, somebody who has more access to citizenship, right, even if not being legally an Australian citizen, but things like healthcare, legal structure, social structure, cultural capital in general. So to make things even more interesting, and this ties in again with Chris a bit, the government has a combination of policies and schemes. There is one wonderful policy called Diversity Works! Which is about the benefit of cultural diversity to economy and to corporation and small businesses. And if you can find it on the website, it is actually a rather amusing read. There's not much to say, you just read it and it's self-explanatory. And also, as you know, the government runs a skilled migration scheme. And through the combination of the two, it puts into place a series of filters that determine the profile of migrants. For instance, the English language test will ensure that only people with a certain cultural capital are allowed in. The preferential channels given to certain occupation can influence the ethnic background, gender of applicants. For instance, there was a case of Hungarian welders a few years ago. That was one of the preferred categories, together with hairdressers. So diversity work is, diversity works is based on demographic and labor market research, so that the officials from the Department of Immigration and Citizenship every so often set up a migration fair in target countries to recruit target migrant workers. So, for instance, accountant from North America and Shanghai, that sort of thing. So in this way, these filters, I think, are biopolitical filters, because they are used to define not so much who is left out of the body of the nation, but who comes in and then takes part in the making of the body of the nation. So they are put into place by a management of difference intended as a productive force, and a difference that is imagined as harmony. So harmony involves the affirmation of difference, which is accepted. So the movement is this: first difference is included, then is accepted, and then is managed, so that in a way, harmony and harmony days are probably some sort of strategy of containment, while at the same time they celebrate difference in terms of postmodern marketing, because that thrives on difference. And they are non-conflictual and harmonious differences. So on one hand, you have this idea of citizenship as a public cultural practice that is related to a juridical definition of citizenship that we have inherited from European Enlightenment. And it is an abstract, and it is a universal, and also it implies the existence of a similarly abstract and universal citizen, who at the same time is the recipient of citizenship and the performer of citizenship. But at the same time, the singular embodiments, or the living quality of the embodiments of people and of the everyday, produce a continuous excess that undermines the very notion of sameness that Howard is imagining, and equality at the core of classic notion of citizenship. And this excess also, and I'm finishing here, this excess also produces, in practical terms, forms of cultural citizenships that can be seen as processes of renegotiating belonging, claiming rights, producing localities, and constituting communities. And this is from Renato Rosaldo. In this definition, cultural citizenship, and this is the Latino studies definition, cultural citizenship originated from a sense of frustration with concepts such as assimilation, integration, acculturation, and multiculturalism, which somehow missed the point of the dynamic processes taking place within Latino and other minoritized communities in USA, which were the sites not only of contestation, but also of affirmation and cultural production. And I think this is what we can work with at present in Australia. So to contrast these homogenized public cultural practices that Howard sees as citizenship, we can probably refer to this, production of excess of cultural citizenship that, in a way, undermines from within. It is a structural problem with citizenship. So it has nothing to do with contingency, I think. It is a structural problem of the notion of citizenship as a universal and an abstract, while it is, embodied. So these practices produce forms of resistance and of conflictual difference that reintroduce the idea of friction. Friction intended not simply as a conflict, although I think that the idea of conflict is quite important, and it is, doesn't have to be a negative idea. I think there is a positive, unproductive production there. But it's also intended as the way that global connection come to life in friction, the grip of the world they encounter, as Annette Singh, or as an anthropologist studying Indonesia, defines it. So these cultural practices, to explain what, you know, the Singh's point, these cultural practices are shaped by transnational dialogues and the persistence of particular historical encounters. And I will finish with an example from Western Sydney. Vodafone, that is a global corporation, sponsored training for young people. The project is taken up by Information and Cultural Exchange, and in particular by MC Trey, who is a Fijian-born rapper from Western Sydney. She teaches urban music to kids from Arab, Asian, and Pacific backgrounds, and all of them exploring their being situated specifically in Western Sydney. So to me, this is quite an important, you know, it is in a way an important paradigm to think about what happens when the multiculturalism that is imagined by harmony, which is a contained, if you want, contained multiculturalism. What happens when multiculturalism starts to fray? What happens when you have kids from all these different backgrounds sort of, you know, producing music together? And I think that that is, and this is where my research is going anyway, so I don't have an answer for this, but I think that maybe this is a new, a particularly Australian, or if you want, Sydney-based, situated definition of the cosmopolitan, which is given by the fraying of this, of multicultural. And I'll finish here.